Hello everyone, thank you very much. So I'm very happy to join you today. I do know some of you. So my name is Céline Roussel. I shall chair this session. I am French, but I live in Germany. I'm 32 years old. I'm calling here from Munich, since we shall talk today about the disordering of sight and blindness and sensory experience. I'll provide you with no more visual insight, but I just want to say that I've changed my and replaced my Dale teacher's costume with my evening teachers. So we are welcoming Max Hubelacker Andrade, Charlotte Makepeace, and Bertrand Verin. Charlotte will start this session. Charlotte, you are writing a PhD thesis, and you work on today's blindness and knowledge of senses in modernist literature. You are a PhD candidate at the University of Leeds since 2019, and you are eager to hear from you, and you also benefit from a guide dog. Your guide dog user, so Charlotte, the floor is yours now.
So I said, hi, I'm Charlotte. I'm a university candidate at Leeds University. I am 26 years old. I have long blonde hair, and I am about 90% certain I'm wearing a blue top, but it may be green or it may be purple. So my PhD looks at blindness, knowledge, and the senses in modernist literature. I'm, I think, a second year. I took some maternity leave, so I'm slightly out of kilter with the rest of my cohort. So far, the paper that I uploaded for this is the only chapter I've kind of written in substance, and I look at modernist authors such as D.H. Lawrence, James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, and Catherine Mansfield. I've only written on D.H. Lawrence's short story, The Blind Man, so far. So my research looks at how we figure blindness both today and kind of in modernist literature. So I've been looking at the history of blindness and kind of the tropes that came up in the previous round, the previous panel, seeing is knowing, the castration complex, compensatory sense, or kind of inspiration versus burden. So I look at how all of those came into being and how they are being kind of particularly prevalent or subverted in the modernist period, but equally how looking at those kind of texts that are far removed from our time now still has an impact on kind of the lived experience of a blind person. So obviously I'm a guide dog user and I am registered blind, so I'm currently trying to work out how to kind of add blindness into my methodology. So I'm looking a lot at David Bowl, Robert McCrewer, to see how my experience as a blind person impacts what I'm researching and writing about. And kind of the main gist so far is I've been looking at how D.H. Lawrence undermines the seeing is knowing trope, because he's very suspicious of sight as it's linked to, kind of the more rational, cold, scientific ideas of knowledge, and he puts forward a more sensory type of knowledge, something more intimate, touch-based, based in the darkness. So he creates a very interesting system of kind of bodily, sensory, visceral feeling, as opposed to kind of, I guess, like the cataloguing epistemology that goes along with sight. I think that's everything. That's okay.
Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup. C'est effectivement un plaisir d'entendre.
Thank you very much. It is indeed a pleasure to hear you sharing your PhD work and to see that there are numerous PhD works being done globally. So I shall leave the floor after these few words of introduction to Max Ederley, André, who shall present his work. So the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you so much. No, I'm very glad to have resolved my technical difficulties. So it's can everyone hear me okay? Yes, wonderful. Okay, so it's really wonderful to be here today. My name is Max Ivalacar Andrade. I'm speaking to you today from Woburn, Massachusetts, in the United States. I'm sighted, 42 years old, white, and I have a slim build. Right now I have a white linen shirt on with thin blue and green vertical lines. I have brown hair that reaches just past my shoulders, and in the background are a set of bookshelves with a bunch of my books. And so I want to really just thank everyone who's made this conference possible, especially Hannah, Marion, and Vanessa. And so in terms of my work, in 2019, I published a book on Jorge Luis Borges, JorgeLuisBorges, titled Borges Beyond the Visible. And the title was really meant to suggest two things. One is that his fiction actively subverts the conventional visual expectations of the reader in really different and unusual ways. And two, that these strategies of representation require readers to mistrust narrators and work through contradictions and intertextual puzzles that really require sustained attention and work, right? And so I should say that after the last session, I'm very interested in the criticism of Borges's representations of blindness and in the proposed Borges bashing. So maybe there'll be time for that in the discussion. I, at least very personally, am super happy with the idea of diminishing the fame of Borges or his monumental or emblematic status, both of which, for me, really distort the understanding of his own work, and obviously can get in the way of an appreciation of all the diverse range of experiences of blindness and blind people that have been spoken about, right, in different eras and cultural contexts. I wanted to start just by saying that one of the traditions that really informs Borges's disruptive practice of visual representation is connected with his representation, with his relationship with someone named Macedonio Fernandez, spelled MacedonioFernandez. And this was a mentor of his, a friend of his father's in Buenos Aires, who really believed that the act of reading could be profoundly transformative, and that the self was an illusion that we actively fashion based on our own complex relationship with external stimuli. And so when we enter into a different context, such as the really strange experience of reading, right, this immersive imagination of a literary reality, he had this sense that ourselves change as well in subtle ways. And so he believed if there could be a kind of fiction that could break away from the tools of realism to allow people to pay attention to the condition of being in fiction, this could allow people to become more free, to loosen the hold of the conventions of everyday life, right? And so Borges shared a lot of these goals and, you know, devised stories that, borrowing from all kinds of theological traditions, especially those with iconoclastic or aniconic practices or traditions, played with different kinds of visual allure and often framed that those objects of visual allure as traps. And so these strategies of visual representation always, or at least often, differentiated between optical experiences and visual experiences. And so the optical experiences are more tied to these kind of everyday conventions. And he was interested in shifting to this kind of visual zone, which involved imagination, which involved a more kind of chaotic spatial sensory organization of being. And so shifting the attention of the reader to what they are actually doing as they read, fashioning a world, a self, perhaps, in their own mind, is one of the first steps in this kind of destabilizing project. So he really loved this profound strangeness of reading and bringing that strangeness into the fabric of his writing. And so I found that these aspects of Borges's fiction are in close conversation with his own experiences of blindness and with blindness. His father and paternal grandmother were both blind, and like them, his sight diminished really slowly throughout his life. He considered himself blind when, echoing some of the ideas from the previous sessions, in 1955, he was no longer able to use his eyes to read or write unassisted. So that context of work, that context of reading, were both, you know, represented a moment that he would offer as kind of a shifting into that identity. So in the document that I shared, I present two really different stories of his. And the first was written when he had some diminished sight and was anticipating being blind in the future. And the second was written after he identified as blind. And I tried to tease out some of the differences in those two texts. So I would just briefly suggest that the kind of liberation that Macedonio was pointing to in this very philosophical and personal context finds a really new resonance in Borges's project. Especially with the way that he opens up to this form of visual complexity, nuance, and multidimensionality that goes beyond or surpasses what's possible in a strictly optical register. So the reader, over and over again, is asked to let go of conventional vision or conventional understandings of sight in order to enter into these stranger zones. And so I really just love to emphasize that the literary reorganization and transformation of the senses in each of Borges's texts is really crucial to the approach that I'm interested in, which is not really articulate one definition, one strategy. I've found that my practice is very descriptive. You know, so I try to approach each literary text with an attention to how sensory cues are transformed in the strangeness of this literary framework where things have to be imagined into being. And that kind of moment of openness requires for the conventional expectations, the centrality of kind of ocular knowledge to be left behind. And so there are very different ways that he does that in his texts. And amazing moments that involve like, for example, moments when having an optical encounter with the actual text makes it more difficult to perceive what's being stated. Really subtle ways in which the visual component of the stories is subverted, interrupted, displaced, where people are drawn in with their desire to see, and then having that revealed as a trap, something that's stultifying and limiting. And so for me, it's not necessarily possible or desirable to articulate super direct causal relationships between Borges's relationship with blindness and these the complex ways he orchestrates this sensory information in fiction. But for me, it's super important for them to be in conversation with one another in order to arrive at this deeper appreciation of what his fiction has the capacity to do. So those are my initial thoughts, and thank you for listening.
Merci beaucoup. Et vous avez eu la gentillesse
de... Thank you very much. You were kind enough to correct my mistake because I forgot to introduce you. I'm really sorry, since you're destructuring things here, we're going to change this. So you're a deputy professor at Latin studies at the University of Massachusetts, and you are living close to the city of Boston in the USA, and research pertained to visual aspects in literary text, which is a very important viewpoint in this colloquium. And I hope we'll be able to talk about this later as we approach the three key questions of this conference. Thank you very much for providing us with an insight to your work, and we shall deepen into another world with Bertrand Verrine. Bertrand Verrine, I won't make the same mistake, and I shall introduce you. You are honorary senior lecturer at the University Paul Valéry in Montpellier, so you are in Montpellier this evening, and you work pertaining to the expressions of touch, a tactile expression, both in writing but also spoken language. You are in charge of the scientific work for the touch or tactile foundation.org. Lots of documents are available on this web platform, and you're also in charge of culture at the APDV Association. Association is the former AGDR, the Blind Intellectual Association. So the floor is yours, actually. Thank you, Céline. It is a pleasure to meet again after so many lockdown periods. So I live in Montpellier. I am here in Montpellier this evening. I am a Mediterranean person, average size, little hands, big nose, short hairs, and I'm losing some of my hairs, actually. And I usually wear black glasses in public because my right orbit was actually damaged by radiotherapy, which didn't stop cancer when I was 5 years old. I'm now 62, so there is a life indeed after the loss of sight. I want to introduce my work now, and I shall repeat some of the things that have been said by Selina and by Corinne. I would like to talk about the La Nuit qu'on suppose artwork from Benjamin Doust, Doust, dating from 2030, dated back from 2013. Old activist for the blind people says we're talking about biodiversity of the plants, but we could talk about the biodiversity of people as well. And with many other movie directors and writers, people, Benjamin looked into the life of the blind people, and oculocentrism was important. And the people who could see his movies said that it was a great movie, but the illustration of the biodiversity of the people, it was actually one of the great benefits of this movie, because he made so much work to come up with this movie so as to illustrate culture, the different senses of touch that this movie evidences that, yes, indeed, there can be a life after blindness, but moreover, there is a life next to blindness, and that is a discovery or a recent discovery in humanities. Experiences are taking place in psychology, which proves that a minority of blind people have a memory and an understanding that privileges hearing, and some of them privileges the touch sense. Some works made in anthropology are very interesting, looking at the contributions of the senses of the hands and the tactile vocabulary for craftsmen, but also people collecting seaweeds, for instance, are overworks, overtreads. We cannot always see the objects they actually handle. So biology and humanities in the 20th and 21st century are rediscovering that human perception is multisensory. This is obvious, but this obviousness is hidden by a hierarchy of senses in the Western world. And in reality, there is people habits of languages and technologies dedicated to the sight, mainly very few being dedicated to the other senses of a human being. So, that movies illustrates and promotes the biodiversity of our senses, and I'm working on this as well, and I hope to provide some arguments that there are many ways to deal with blindness. I have identified three important families which can be used in different ways or combined. First of all, nostalgia of light and the fact that one can be fascinated by the loss of sight, using emotions, feelings, imagination, and the culture and the use of other senses. And I am trying to work on this topic, i.e. using a diversity of senses, especially when it comes to the touch. I have two main objectives. I want to understand why in the 20th century it was more or less hidden in the Western world, and to know and to understand by which means, and especially through literature, we can have a mindful body so that everyone, blind and people, sighted people alike, can use that sense. Thank you very much for your introduction that helped us to use very relevant terms when talking about the biodiversity of people. I can recognize your character, your personality. I think, yes, that phrase, that expression, biodiversity, is very interesting indeed. Yes, life after the loss of sight, but there is life also next to blindness, that is true. You have recently published a book completely dedicated to the sense of touch, which is a true literary exploration, looking at a wide range of topics and texts pertaining to touch. And you have devised and thought of different categories or criteria, such as the temperature and other criteria. Thank you very much. I will use the next 5 minutes to make a summary of what is expected from me, and then I will do a write-up with great pleasure. So thank you to the three of you. This session is dedicated to the questioning of the language structure based on sight, decentering sight. That is what at stake here. So you're doing this all differently. And this session and this round table is looking at the different senses that can be explored, that are also illustrated in the different work of arts, texts, which show why it is important to analyze the text under this viewpoint, what it can bring us for the understanding of blindness, but also for the understanding of literature. So this viewpoint is really interesting, knowing what the literary text can do to the sight or the vision is important. Max Eberlacher Andrade, you highlighted that in Borges there is a poetics that calls to the imagination of the readers, bears on contradictions, and sometimes the text are meaningful, sometimes less. I think it is really interesting that highlights the power of the reading, the power of the text to challenge the language structures which are conventional, which are standardized, and in Borges, that challenges the power, the overall power of a vision, hence leading to a decentering viewpoint about sight. So I think you three texts are really very interesting. They're very personal as well. I was stricken by the fact that there's always two viewpoints, two angles in your works. You link the visual works to your personal experiences. That this could be obvious for you, Bertrand, and also for you, Charlotte McPhee, because you're blind people. But I have also found that dimension in Max Eberlacher Andrade's work. So as for this viewpoint of the daily activities, you, Bertrand Vérine, you have devised competitive exams for some texts. And some blind people were requested to talk about the experience, to write up about their daily life. You have also carried out another experiment, a psychological experiment, actually, and you were inspired by the description of a group of people, and I know quite well you work, and I know that your research work is based on your life experience, which provides you with meaningful and relevant information. I have to say that in the text that you submitted, Max, I also found something which is interesting. You discover progressively the meaning of Borges' text. It's like a quest, an endless quest, and you also discover this through your daily life. In an encyclopedia, you discovered something, a key to understand Borges' text. And Charlotte, you also questioned the different terms we use on a daily basis, the idioms, of course, seeing as understanding, of course. This viewpoint is also used by other authors, such as John Marfin Hull, Hull, H-U-L-L. And I looked it up for you because I think he is talking about this question in his journal Touching the Rock, 1993. At the beginning of his text, he highlights the fact that our language depends on our vision, in how much of our language is dependent of our homages through sight. And he adds later, the whole structure of our... So I think that your contributions deal with a matter that is to... verbalism, which is you dealt with at the in the education debates, i.e., that blind people would privilege some structure of language, not necessarily based on their daily life experiences, but I think you give how you privilege the multi-approach of senses. And I would say, to sum up in one word, the feeling I had when reading all your works, I had the feeling that you, Max, you're shaking this disruption with the visual convention in your text. I was really impressed by the important number of adjectives, verbs you use to describe the language in Borges's text. Destabilizing, subversion, dissolving. The act of seeing is avoided, delayed, erased. The text talk about the erasing, the destruction of the visual field, and to prompt us to diversify the interpretations so when dealing with blindness. So I think you're really you're challenging us, Charlotte. Your text is done on the relationship that exists between the conventional sight and knowledge. And in the text that you analyze, you can see that the act of not seeing is a knowledge in itself. Bertrand, I looked a verb that could illustrate your work, and I found the verb bringing more fabric. You provide to enrich the text. I think you can enrich really things. So I am really impassioned to open the discussion to know where you what you think about these blindness studies. What is your position about these blindness studies? We can discuss this now. So the first question I shall ask is, where do you situate your work within French-speaking disability studies? Max, do you want to start? Maybe
sure,
less obvious for you.
I would love to. I think that the way that I situate my reading practice and my writing practice is first to establish, I think, different dimensions of experience, right? For me, I take like relatively seriously this idea that of different contexts. So sometimes for me, one particular poem, one particular story, even one particular autobiographical text operates really under its own strange logic, you know. And so wherever possible, I try to not impose the same framework, right? So to try to feel what is happening in each text by itself. And so for me, that requires a critical attention to the conventions that, as people have mentioned, are very ubiquitous and have this palimpsestic kind of weight around us. And so that's the first thing that I would say. And I said that I'm also very cautious about one particular narrative of blindness for Borges himself, right? Because there's this whole progression of different experiences that he has with blindness across his life in his everyday context, and each story and each poem has this different articulation, which a lot of times we have to really mistrust and find our ways around. And so I, especially as a teacher, as someone who teaches these texts as well, engaging in a dialogue where I work to have students be aware of the expectations or conventions that they might be projecting on the text is a major component of what I do. And for that, I think that I'm deeply indebted to disability studies. The second thing that I would just really briefly say, not to speak too much, would be that these pockets of different sensory transformations, these zones that people can step into, I do feel that I believe that they have this capacity to loosen people's understanding of different possibilities of being, instead of hewing to the rigidity of the pre-established categories. And so I think that it has a role, even outside of the everyday context, to do that work. So maybe I'll have those be the initial thoughts.
Oui, très bien, merci beaucoup. Oui, je pense que c'est vraiment intéressant puisqu'on dit...
Thank you very much.
Travail sur les disability studies, on pousse, on incite hein, chacun...
In the context of disability studies, everybody is being pushed to be aware of their representations, and the work that you are doing with students is to make them aware of what they project onto a text, onto something, and in that... There is an obvious parallel with one of the presuppositions regarding disability studies and the fact that you deploy, analyze the way a text of experiential text is deployed. And this joins the biodiversity that you were talking about earlier, Bertrand. Maybe someone would like to pick up Bertrand, Charlotte. Would you like to follow on from that answer?
Alors,
oui, Bertrand, vous pouvez continuer.
Ouais, bon, donc c'était.
I'll go ahead then. I immediately said to Hannah and Marion that when they got in touch, that I felt I was in parallel with the studies. I didn't feel that I was in the heart of blindness studies, disability studies, because I was living in blindness and I had trouble looking at blindness from outside, from a scientific position. So in the text that I put up, that Marion put up for me, thank you, Marion, I had to find another point from which to come at the issue. It's very linked to personal contingencies, the negativity, the struggle between blindness and see and vision. We all have to deal with it on a daily basis, but I wanted to, particularly in literary terms and in general discourse, I wanted to find some positivity. And therefore, I decided to define blindness as a positive, i.e., accessing certain experiences in life through other ways, sensory ways other than sight. That is what being blind means to me. I'll stop there for the time being. You were very accurate, you were very clear in your positioning regarding French studies, French disability studies. Charlotte, maybe you want to also answer that question, how you position yourself with regard to these different research projects. We should be able to hear you, I think.
Fantastic. I use disability studies quite heavily in my PhD. My work kind of intersects disability studies and modernist studies, I guess. I think there's been a real maybe lack of research about kind of this specific moment in history in relation to blindness studies in that with, you know, World War One, the invention of the telescope, the X-ray, the microscope, the interiority that comes with modernism, that desire to deconstruct and aestheticize, I think it opens up some really kind of fascinating questions about sites and the decentering of sites and the sensory, the haptic. And I feel it's been, you know, there are books that are looking at it, but that it tends to be more, you know, chapters as opposed to a huge focus. And I think it's a really interesting cultural moment. And I'm also using disability studies to kind of try and situate myself amongst my work, because as a blind person, I'm trying to find a language to express my lived experience in an academic sense. Like I said, I'm looking at David Bolt, Robert McCrewer, but I feel like I'm so used to talking about my blindness, you know, in an informal setting, maybe, you know, amongst friends or talking in those kind of situations. It feels like quite a leap to then find a way to express myself in a more kind of formal academic way, using my experience to further my research, as opposed to it just kind of being a side note. I want it to be a really primary focus of my research, because looking at, say, blindness in modernism from the perspective of a blind person, I feel it offers something very interesting. So yeah, I'm using I situate myself quite firmly among disability studies.
Bien, très bien, merci. Et est-ce que vous partagez aussi cette définition positive de la cécité?
Do you share that positive definition that of blindness that Bertrand Vérine has? Do you share his positive view of blindness? Are you in agreement with that definition? Does it resonate with your experience and your experiences of what you've read?
I definitely like to align myself with a positive definition of blindness. I think a lot of my research, I'm hoping, can be kind of generative and kind of provoke that sense of change. And I think that exploring where these kind of negative or damaging stereotypes come from, you know, tracking their history and language and looking at ways to, so kind of been looking at how metaphor, how a lot of metaphor relies heavily on these damaging versions of sight, i.e., you know, seeing is knowing, or that being a dim idea or a bright idea. So I'm looking at all of that, and I think that we can create a more positive sense of blindness if we understand where the negativity comes from. And I guess I'm trying to create a positive sense, and I'm trying to use my lived experience in a positive manner. But I do find quite a lot of negativity. I think, obviously, with a lot of the authors I'm reading, it's quite troubling. It's quite distressing at times. Mm. Some of the representations are not the most positive, but I think talking about it can bring something positive out of it.
D'accord, merci beaucoup pour votre réponse. Alors, je poserai plus ou moins la même question à
Thank
Max.
Thank you for your answer. I'd like to ask more or less the same question to Max. What is the definition of blindness that Borges' texts writing provides?
Yeah, so I would... am I unmuted? Make sure. Yeah, okay. I think that I would explore kind of different simultaneous ways of asking that question with him, because I think that if we move into his fiction, some of the stories, there are lots of ways in which sightedness is positioned as an impediment, truly, that as a way of being excessively tied to this everyday mode of existence, which means that readers might be excessively tied to their conventional everyday selves and less able to participate in an expanded sense of being, basically, right? So one of his most famous stories involves a magical object that will grant people with sight, perfect sight, this total vision, you know. But in the story, it slowly gets reframed as a trap, because it makes people profoundly uncreative. It stalls the ability to be surprised. It And it functions as a way of misunderstanding the nature of creativity, of curiosity, of constructing one's own world, because everything is provided so passively to these people. Right? So sightedness is sometimes associated with this kind of passive consuming of reality without questioning. And at the end of that story, there's a kind of a hidden version of that magical object that's buried inside of a pillar of the Amr Mosque in Cairo. And this is an object that is the same. It connects to this universe, but in order to be apprehended, one has to touch it and put one's ear close to it. So in a sense, to kind of sense its rumbling and imagine a world, and everyone's going to imagine that world in a different way. So there's this kind of shift, and it's kind of buried inside of the story. So a lot of people, when they read Borges, might say, oh, yeah, he's the inventor of the this wonderful object, which we associate with his genius, this total vision. But when read a bit more closely, there's a critique of that. It's seen as a trap, as something that is kind of makes people boring. Right? And so, and there's a lot of moments like that in his stories. Yeah. Yeah. So that's something that so in his fiction, there'll be a lot of these moments. In his kind of everyday writing about his own relationship with blindness, we'll find a different version of things, right? Where he has been speaking to a particular audience about trying to dispel some of the stereotypes and some of the expectations of people in a more of a conversational mode. In some of his interviews with friends or recorded talks, he'll use a sense of humor that a lot of times we don't find in his stories, laughing about how people treat him as though he's this kind of magical being, and how his editors want to present him as a blind author instead of as a severely short-sighted one because it sells more copies, things like that. So there's different modes of articulating this identity. And for me, it's very important not to hold on to one, to really open up to the particularities of each moment. And instead of interpreting the ideas, to as much as possible sense the cues that are given or not given in each particular text, and let that logic guide my approach and thought.
Merci beaucoup, effectivement, sous des idées très, très
Thank intéressantes. Thank you again.
puisque vous donnez aussi...
You give us...
Alors, j'ai une interprétation qui se fait en direct. Excusez-moi, je n'ai pas l'habitude d'utiliser...
My interpretation is direct. I'm not used to using this facility.
Je n'ai pas trouvé.
I wasn't able to find the way to put my hand up virtually.
Alors, je suis un tout petit peu perdue techniquement. Célina, oui. Vous avez posé une question.
Célina, you asked a question.
Est-ce que Céline,
alors je reprendrai simplement donc sur
I would like to pick up again
de Max Baerlaker and Dalade,
on what Max said,
puisque vous avez bien montré donc
you have shown us,
que enfin vous avez défini en fait la vision,
you have de vision
assez convaincante
in a convincing way.
Peut-être que je pourrais redonner la parole,
hand over again to
la parole à vous trois pour vous
dire
comment vous caractériseriez donc les études sur la
cécité. How would you describe blindness studies?
Question du colloque.
One of the main questions of this conference.
Vous pourriez répondre.
I don't really know which one of you could answer first. Yes, I could answer that. As little as I know about it, I'm not an English speaker, so I've only read short bits and pieces because of my limited knowledge of English, only the bits and pieces that have been translated into French. We are still stuck in the binary seeing, non-seeing situation. I have tried to move the goalposts and head towards other forms of sensoriality, including by toppling in a slightly provocative way for about a century. After 1852 till 1950, seeing people became what we could say as a caricature, blind to their other sensations, to their other senses. Touch, hearing, smell and taste disappeared to an extent. These senses, this disappearance of these senses interests me. This disappearance, at least at the academic level, with a reluctance in literature that appears very early and then bit by bit acquires more and more importance over and above other senses. Mm-hmm. There are a few writers that are particularly obvious in this area, Stefan Zweig, Jean Giono. But you can find others, you can find traces of this much earlier. For example, Stendhal and Victor Hugo are maybe very massively visual. Balzac, however, introduces frequently little touches of smell and noise and feel and touch, extraordinary touches throughout his work, but I'm not quite at the heart of the question. It's very interesting nonetheless. Thank you. I have a technical issue here. I had a technical issue with interpreting. I wanted to be much more enthusiastic to the answer that you gave, Max, as to your definition of blindness, but also of vision. I think your approach is very complementary to that of Bertrand, as we have a tendency to define blindness and polysensoriality that stems from it, but we also need to talk about the traps, the snares of vision that you talk about. Very convincing what you talked about. You talk about so many different interpretations and ambivalence that I find particularly interesting. The slight irony that you found the key to his text in an edition of the encyclopedia where you found an image that appears in a text of Borges, whilst the text itself has the theological concept of Islam as refusing pictures, refusing images. I think there is it's slightly ironic there. That is typical of Borges. And I think that you showed it well, how we move in we find our way forward in the labyrinth of the text, and how the universe of his fiction must not be understood in a visual, optical way, but also by efforts of interpretation. One, we are faced by texts that are based on polysensoriality. We also can be led towards different interpretations and sliding meaning and different sensorialities, and certain tactile figures need to be interpreted. I think your work really echoes that.
There's another moment that's really wonderful that just to share very briefly, in which in the story The Library of Babel, there's without explaining the whole story, of course, it has to do with this library that it contains all of the possible texts that, you know, all of the possible texts that can be made from a variation of a certain number of symbols, so like 25 symbols. And so the idea is, in this infinite library, every single possible text is there. And most of them are gibberish because they're just recombinations of letters, right? But there's one text that's hidden inside the story, because the people who live in this library, which is as large as the universe, it's like a hell, because they're surrounded by all these books that are impossible to read. they feel like everything's already been said. It's this horrible situation. But if one is not reading the actual text in a book, it is much easier to understand that what one is reading is actually a manuscript, right, that someone has written on the back of one of these books, and that the handwriting would be radically different from these perfect symbols that repeat themselves over and over again in this kind of hellish landscape. And so being able to, but for a sighted reader, they're reading regular symbols that are interchangeable, similar to these other books, so that the difference of the manuscript that one is reading evaporates for sighted readers. But for someone who's simply who's listening to the story, for example, that same kind of tension doesn't show up, and so this key text is much more available as a text that contradicts the logic of the rest of the story. So that's a kind of a counterexample of where the sightedness of a reader prevents or can get in the way of understanding the difference between this manuscript that one is reading and the rest of these perfect organizations of printed letters.
I think you raise a really interesting point there about kind of this, like actually taking the kind of the sighted reader in mind, because I found, obviously, I work largely through speech programs or audiobooks. So I've had, like, say, the very strange experience of listening to D.H. Lawrence not read in a Nottinghamshire accent. So you get a very strange sense of dialect. Or, like, I had to read James Joyce's Ulysses. I had to read parts of it in Braille to kind of understand syntax and the structure and the layout of the sentences, which, again, just doesn't... I couldn't access through an audiobook, but I could access haptically, which someone else could have accessed through sight. So I think you raise a really interesting, possibly aspect of blindness studies about how we come to the text as much as what we read in it.
Merci beaucoup de partager effectivement ce texte.
Thank you for sharing all this and your thoughts. It helps us to bridge the gap, rather unexpected gap, between literary fiction of Borges and the very practical modern accessibility of texts. Reading as a trap, visual reading as a trap, is something that is very interesting. Thank you. I would like now to take one question. You can choose whether or not you answer. I would be interested to know what you think about verbalism. How do you position yourself with regard to this question of verbalism? Is this something that for you is a topic of debate that should be discussed? Or is it just a notion that can be relegated to sociology without having any real influence on our literary analyses? I would be curious to know your opinion on this question. Or maybe to state it slightly differently, we often hear behind the word verbalism the fact that we should ban or privilege the use of expressions that, based on sensorialities that are other than sight. Some people who would ban expression based on sight, how would you react to that? Terrifying, terrifying.
Okay, I think that this debate is ancient, really. And the basis of the debate are not sound, not very good, actually. It didn't start well because the border existed and it was not really well mastered. A border between blindness and the perception of reality and the cognitive structuring, an intellectual structuring. And therefore, this led that at a given point of time, some authors have thought that blindness had to be associated with autism or other disorders, especially in young children or infants. So really, the basis were wrong. And for some linguistic matters, linguistic reasons, that is a traditional recurrent issue, the real references and the meaning of the words were confounded. And at the end of the 20th century, language words had or were supposed to have specific meanings. This is why I really love the text by Giono, which I mentioned in my contribution to this colloquium, because Giono introduced the idea that there are several ways to talk about things, to name things. As for verbalism as such, on the one hand, we are all verbalists at a given point in time, because we hear about a reality that we have not experienced, and it can be also very useful for communication purposes. And I like to tell that story. You may have seen that I have been careful not to talk about the color of my skirt nor of my hairs, because to me, as an individual, colors are meaningless. And to me, colors are terms, names, expressions that are being used to communicate with sighted people, that allow to communicate quickly with sighted people rather than using tactile touch sensations or expressions. So my shirt, you know, I think I would not say is white, but it is, if it features stripes, it has a given thickness, a given length. That's what I could say. But when I talk with my wife, who is sighted, I just talk about my white skirt, my pink skirt. And of course, preserving biodiversity, you know, I said that. But it is my personal experience, that experience of the lack of vision. I know very well, and I respect the fact that people who have lost sight at a later stage in their life need to know the color of things, because that recall things to them. But to me, that doesn't mean anything. And even more, I think that many psychologists would not consider as verbalism the fact that I'm talking about the color of my shirt, because they would think I would be reintegrated with the community of sighted people. So this matter was badly debated at the beginning, really. But I think that of speakers, I'm thinking about Delphine or Castrud, who will be speaking on Monday, I think next week, will be talking about this in a much better way than I am doing. Thank you for helping us to untangling these threads, really, so to speak. Thank you very much for your reactions. I shall leave the floor to Anna, who will lead that Q&A session. So,
We've got a couple of questions. I know Selena wants to ask a question, but I want to go first to Aravinda Bhatt. It's lovely to see you again, Aravinda. Would you like to ask a question, please?
Thank you, Hannah. I hope I'm visible and audible.
Yes, yes, you are.
Yes. I have listened to all the speakers, and it has been wonderful. Also, a special hello to Max, with whom I've been in touch for nearly a decade. And my question is to him. Max, you said that you distinguish between Borges's optical experience and visual practice in literature. I don't know if I'm getting this correct. I'd like you to clarify that. And the second question, since of course this session is about decentering sight, however, I couldn't listen to the previous session because here it is late in the evening and I was very tired and couldn't join the previous session. So I believe there was discussion on Borges. However, due to my inability to join it, maybe I'm repeating some questions, but please, I'd be grateful for your answers. So my first question you did hear. The second one is, in what way do you think Borges's experience of not being able to see, the blind experience, and his other sensory experiences come into his fiction as well as his poetry? Now, I know that this is a very rudimentary question, but nevertheless, I'd like your response, because right now I'm at work on a book dealing with Borges, Hull, and Stephen Quisisto. So, thank you.
Thank you for both of those questions. I'm trying to figure out the best way to answer. So I think that the first thing that comes to mind, taking the last question first, because it's most recent in my memory, is that whenever I was first writing about Borges and the strategies that he uses, I think that I began to talk about how he interrupts or disrupts this this visual allure that he constructs strategically in his stories to create an opportunity for people to appreciate what is happening in the moment of reading, which does not involve the eyes as much as it does involve this mental process of fashioning a world in a way that is not strictly optical, right? That might involve memories of sight, might involve other kind of aspects that might be connected with sight, but also could involve this kind of reconfiguration of the senses in the mind, right? So it's this really radical shift that he tries to create. And so first up, I was talking about how there was a push away from the visual into a more touch-oriented or listening or other kinds of senses. But it occurred to me that in both sides of this shift that he's conditioning, there are very visual elements. And what I felt that he was really distancing him from more specifically was an optical register in which the eyes are foregrounded as the main way of knowing, instead of a more visual component in which the flexibility and chaos of an imagination is able to produce really radically different possibilities that go beyond those conventions. So for me, it was an important differentiation to make.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And the second thing that I wanted to say is that in preparation for this conference, I really did want to see what would happen in foregrounding blindness in a way that was different than my process of writing. And I felt that one of the risks that I wanted to avoid was to express a certainty in causality or to put too much prominence on Borges's blindness, because there are many different factors that led to these strategies. So I preferred to kind of have these things in conversation with one another without requiring this caused that. This was the reason for that. Because it, for me, it opened up a little bit more the space of not knowing and the space of the complexity of the creative process. So those are two things that I would come to mind. One is it's very important for these things to be in conversation. I'm not comfortable with causality because the way blindness can be overdetermined and overemphasized as a factor. And that's my effort to differentiate between the purely optical and a visual, which can extend beyond that. So hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you. Hannah, I hope I can just end with one point here. I don't want to take up too much time of the session. However, I appreciate your view, Max, that you wanted to keep these various, meanings of visuality or visualization in conversation, in critiquing Borges's writings and his aesthetic approach. However, as a blind person myself, I'm interested to know if there is a way to talk about his lived experience of blindness, of not being able to see, in a way that it does not overdetermine his aesthetic approach. Now, as I began this last point, I don't want to take up too much of the time. So maybe we could have a conversation later. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, my answer is I hope so. I think that there are so many different ways of narrating these things. So I'm optimistic.
I think, but yeah, thank you. Thank you, Max. And thank you, Aravinda. I think that there's a very interesting connection to be made with something that Charlotte said about the way that she accesses texts, and kind of lived, like our lived experience as readers, and how non-visual reading defines, and in the case of Borges, non-visual writing defines or has a relationship with the text, which I'd really like to come back to if we've got time. But I'm going to ask Selina to ask her question now. Selina, do you want to unmute and ask your question, please?
Hello, and thank you to both speakers, particularly Max, because I feel that I've judged Borges slightly too much. Do you feel that, I suppose what I'm interested in, and I sort of mentioned it previously at my round table, is do you feel that he buys into the binary opposition? Or do you think, from what you've been saying, I think you might answer this question by saying that he actually undoes it or challenges it. But do you think, I just wondered, as somebody who's like really focused on his work, I had always found him slightly indulging in his blindness, in the sense of it was almost his unique selling point. And I wondered if you felt that, or if you felt, I mean, that could just be my reading of it. That's it.
I mean, he definitely mocked the idea that this was a selling point, that people wanted to package him in that way. And so I think that's a factor that he was aware of. I think that whenever, I mean, I think that he did also explicitly write that about his very, the idiosyncrasies of his own experience with blindness, and about how it's very different from the expectations of other people. He wrote about how he described as modest, in a sense of like not wanting to speak for people who had other experiences with blindness, and so I think he strategically positions himself in a way where he says that this is for him another form of life, another form of being, another style of life, but also some of the work that he does more in that zone of speaking directly about his blindness in a non-fictional zone is to tried to, I think, just speak to his own experiences without having people put on these kinds of stories on him. So I'm thinking of what you've got.
Exactly. So the thing I was thinking about as we were all talking was, we need a word.
Mm.
We do need a word to say, I can't see, or I can't, I cannot participate in this way, or I can do it a different way. So I just, what I slightly worry about, and I think I opened this to the whole room, and it might be part of the whole critical blindness discussion, and it might be something we have to come back to at the end, which is, we do need something. We need some placeholder that describes a state of being and possibly allegories and might acknowledge, I mean, it might be negative or not, because every language, every word can be used and manipulated and mistreated and misused. So I'm just putting that out there. And I wondered if Borges, I don't think Saramago, for example, does it. He just treats blindness as bad, negative, whatever, whereas other writers seem to play with it. I'm just wondering, just generally, and I don't know if Hannah and Vanessa have a view about this, but is, what are we going to do? If we don't use the word blindness, what do we do?
It reminds me of a kind of a Buddhist statement of saying, like, of course, the self is not real, and yet we do have to remember our social security numbers, you know, or we do have to, carry, the driver's license around whenever there's a context, to do that, or it's important to enter into contexts in which traditional identities are going to be very useful. And so
I had to become legally blind. I mean, I found the whole thing hilarious. Was I illegally blind before? Was I running riot with my illegalness?
Can we bring in David Anderson, just because I sense he might have something to add. David Anderson, do you want to come in?
Thank you very much. Great conversation. Thank you to all. I start sort of harp on the same thing. Ecology is part of what I try to bring to blindness studies, and the overall question I have is just. For each of you with the authors and the artists that you're engaging with, I know a little bit about Borges. There's a poem of his that starts with a tombstone, and it's about a river, and it's this neat correspondence between going back and forth through time and how the river itself kind of writes itself into the poem. And I love this conversation about sensoriality and multi or polysensuousness, and also Bertrand talked about a biodiversity and talked about touching kelp. You're not using your eyes to do it. And it made me think also of like non-human species sensorium. So bats, dolphins, butterflies, I found out the other day, with eyes on the ends of their genitals. So I'm curious if any of you and the authors you work with and the ways you think about the senses and this idea of decentering sight, does the non-human world, does nature, does ecology creep in? And I love Selena's question about like, what word do we use? And, I was born visually impaired, and then I've always been legally blind. I've been under the authority of the state all this time. But in my work, I try to think about like this engagement with non-normative sensing people and their engagement with the natural world. And I was just curious, like, Bertrand's work really, I would love to hear more about specifically, but all of you, does nature help to decenter sight or not at all, if that happens? I hope I'm not drawing the conversation in the wrong direction.
No, that's great. Well, let's go to Bertrand d'abord. Bertrand first. Bertrand, est-ce que vous avez entendu la question?
Non, j'ai perdu le son juste après mon prénom.
Alors, en fait, c'est David Anderson, il voulait savoir...
David Anderson was asking, what role does nature and the world of animals play? Is the world of animal, is the animal reign... Could it give us another way of understanding senses? Yes, definitely. I'm not an expert, but I have read a bit on this topic, and I believe that Charlotte could probably talk to us, for instance, about the wonderful novella by Virginia Woolf called Flash, which is the autobiography of a dog, which is a quite an interesting experiment where there was a complete decentering because this dog does not interpret the world through sight very much at all. There is a horrible but prodigious, wonderful book by a writer of a Lebanese, Canadian and French origin, Wajdi Wallam, that is called Anima, and that is where everything is told by a lot of different animals, and it is an exercise in decentering, and it is a nightmarish book, a horrible book. You need to be healthy when reading that book, and I'm sure there are others.
The kind of flip side of David's question, which is the danger of associating blindness with the kind of base animality. I think it's one of the tropes in David Bolt's book that, you know, blindness is kind of linked to the senses, but in quite a bestial way. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how we can navigate the advantages of nature and ecology without falling into that trap.
Oui, du coup, il faut. Ça rejoint la question.
Yes, that joins in on the question of a species-specific vision of life. And rebuilding the discourse on bestiality that we often meet.
I think the modernists do something quite interesting, as kind of we mentioned with Flush, and obviously they.
Nous avons mentionné.
It is a book about an animal, but it's it just shows a different way of knowledge and a different way of experience, in that, you know, you have an animal who accesses the world through smell, through touch, through hearing, as opposed to sight being the most important. I think it was a kind of really interesting kind of way of looking at that order. And obviously for like D.H. Lawrence, nature is hugely important. The city is linked to sight, to intellectualism, to industrialism, to coldness, to rationality, whereas nature is the sensory, the feeling, and almost accessing the world through touch. It becomes a higher power for D.H. Lawrence, so I guess it completely reverses that idea of the bestial being linked, or, you know, kind of blindness being linked to the base or the animal. He completely flips that, like, not necessarily in a disabled advocacy way, but he does it in a really interesting way, which ties into the conversation.
But the other thing about D.H. Lawrence is the sex, right? And that is associated with nature and with the senses. So does that's enough. So there's a really fine line between kind of celebrating the sensory and this kind of over sexualization he was criticized for, and his misogyny as well.
Yeah, obviously you can't get around the misogyny. I think a lot of it, I think people view him as over-sexualized. I think actually a lot of him is just him trying to write intimacy in a way that was incredibly provocative. So I think, again, obviously it's kind of that haptic approach, isn't it? In that it's sex, but it's all about touch, and it does decenter the visual again, and it is animal, but Lawrence wasn't doing it, like, we might perceive it as negatively, but it wasn't negative to him. It all tied into his philosophy on feeling and darkness.
So you're really working to reclaim Lawrence as well as reclaiming blindness, it sounds like.
Incidentally, so it wasn't my intention when I said that. I think he's just doing something fascinating. I don't think he's a disabled advocate. I don't think we should necessarily be living up to standards of Lawrence, but it's just interesting conversations to be having.
Charlotte, can you say a little bit more about I was up because earlier, I think in the first session, you asked a question about how you can navigate your blind identity as an academic. Mm. And I think you actually answered your own question when you said about your what listening and touching words rather than reading them sightedly brings to your analysis. And I wonder if you could say a bit more about how you could use your way of reading to actually provide a new kind of analysis which will push the boundaries of modernist scholarship.
Yeah, because I'm really interested in kind of concepts of sensory reading. Obviously, on a very basic level, I access through Braille or audiobooks, so you've got, you know, the haptic and the auditory. But equally, like, I had a wonderful seminar tutor on my MA who used to do walks around Dublin to all the points of Ulysses, and they'd eat, like, cheese toasties because they did that in the book, and they'd go, and it was a sensory walk around Dublin, and he was reading passages out, and it was just such a wonderful way of accessing what Joyce intended to be a completely sensory experience. So I think you're right that probably does bring a real aspect to research and kind of blindness studies is this different way of accessing and it not being a negative, you know, oh, I can't read print, but it opening up entire new avenues of discovery.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's I think one of the really exciting things that has happened as literature has become more accessible through audio, and it's become much easier for everyone to access audio. Mm. I think we can lead the way in kind of showing how, you know, we can show that you can separate reading from the visual. You know, and that we're not just listening, we're actually actively creating meaning as people do when they use their eyes to read,
as opposed to the assumption how many times the amount of times I've been asked if I'm illiterate, and what people actually mean is how do you read. It's like, I'm capable of doing it, I just do it in a different manner than you.
And it has its own advantages, and that brings back what Max was saying about Max, your way of reading closely and letting this text itself kind of dictate your approach. Mm. I thought that resonated as well. And Bertrand, est-ce que vous avez une façon de lier le,
Bertrand, do you have some way of linking in your way of reading with your analysis?
Oui. Yes.
And for that, I alternate different ways. Basically, I approach text through audio, and once I want to deepen it, I print it out in Braille, or I read it with my Braille tool, but there is always a time when I come back to paper one way or another. And I should point out that it's not the same materiality, unlike what is often read in a lot of magazines, or fingers are not eyes, so reading Braille is not the same materiality as reading with eyes. You do not do it at the same speed, you do not have the same concept, overall concept. What is wonderful with Braille is to be careful, is to pay attention to detail. Even if you read fast, and I do read Braille fast, you are more careful of each word, you pay more attention. You do not look at the whole page. The brain globalizes the entirety of it, but that is a very precious way of accessing the text.
Is this the value, the added value that blind reading brings to texts? I think in terms of practically, kind of literally, but also metaphorically, we've shown throughout this session that blindness can enrich reading and interpretation in many different ways. Okay, we now have first of all, I'd like to thank all the speakers and the audience for their questions. I'd also like to thank Céline for her brilliant, clever way in which she brought all your work together and drew out similarities and differences. We've now got a half an hour, 30 minutes, to have a break, ideally some food, and we start again in at 1:30 with the third round table. So go and have a rest, and then I'll look forward to seeing everyone back in half an hour. And thank you again very much.